Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. It's made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent, and I'm your host, Chris Kingdon Barker. Constitution Day is an American federal observance that recognizes the adoption of the United States Constitution, and it's observed on September 17th, the day the U.S. Constitution Convention signed the Constitution in 1787. The focus of the holiday is to engage the community in an appreciation of the Constitution so they're imbued with an understanding and appreciation for the individual rights and civil liberties it guarantees. The focus of today's show is the importance of the individual rights, civil liberties, and influence the Constitution has on our everyday lives. My guests for today's show are Stu Jenkins, public interest lawyer and secretary of the San Luis Obispo chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, or the ACLU, and Midori Feldman, attorney and president of the San Luis County chapter of ACLU. Today's show is live, and we welcome you to join our discussion with your thoughts, comments, and questions. You can do that by calling in at 805-781-3875. And thank you both, Stu and Midori, for joining me.
You're very welcome. It's nice to be here, Chris.
Good afternoon, Midori. If we start off, let's kind of start back to basics, and the ACLU is what?
Well, it started actually in 1921 or so, and it was a reaction to the ratcheting down of civil rights during World War I that had occurred. There had been anti-sedition laws, and the concept that free speech was protected was not as widely accepted in those days by courts. And so it was started by people like Clarence Darrow, Mrs. Luce, who owned Look magazine and several of the other publications of the day. Helen Keller was on the first board of directors.
Oh, wow.
And it was organized in order to protect individual civil rights under the Bill of Rights, and within just a couple of years, the second affiliate formed in Southern California, and the San Luis Obispo chapter is part of the Southern California affiliate, and that started when there were dock worker strikes also in the 20s, and you had people doing the simple task of climbing into a bell tower over the demonstrations where the police and the Pinkertons were hauling union strikers off in paddy wagons reading the First Amendment, and they were hauled down and arrested. And members of the new affiliate of the ACLU for Southern California kept climbing the tower and reading the Bill of Rights and kept getting arrested for it that day. So that's the genesis of the Southern California affiliate. Midori, our president, actually had served on the local San Luis Obispo chapter for a number of years. She's much younger than this, but this was probably, 18, 20 years ago?
It was about 20 years ago.
And the chapter had died, and we, a number of us brought it back here recently, and we've been working on growing the chapter. And, of course, I don't want to go too long without mentioning the fact that on Saturday at noon in Santa Rosa Park in San Luis Obispo, we're having a Constitution Day barbecue celebration. There's going to be a leg of lamb there. There's going to be a tri-tip and hamburgers and hot dogs for kids. It's only $15, and the the net proceeds is going to go to a scholarship fund for elementary, middle school, and high school student essay contests about the Constitution.
Huh, that's great.
Oh, and this is an annual event we've put on for a number of years.
And is the purpose of this event to really build interest and education in the schools around the Constitution for the kids and,
well, sure,
and the parents?
Sure, and the parents and members. You know, there's actually there's about 700 members of the ACLU in San Luis Obispo County, mm-hmm. and of course we want them all to come. We want the public to come. We'd like folks to get to know more about the Constitution, join the ACLU. The dues are only $35 a year, you know. And, of course, once you are a member, you get all kinds of alerts about issues that the ACLU is dealing with and helping protect civil rights on.
All right. And Midori, can you kind of introduce us? So constitutional law, talk a little bit about what constitutional law is.
Oh, man, that's everything. Everything touches. It's very difficult to separate it out.
And yet it's a practice, right? It's constitutional law is by its own definition type of practice?
Constitutional law, it's the underlying rules for all the laws. So that's why it's so difficult to separate it out. And oftentimes when you're dealing with a specific lawsuit, oftentimes, or a legal action, you really do need to look at that underlying law. And almost everything out there, you can find some basis for your argument in the Constitution, whether it be taxes. I mean, because that's really where the whole fight began with the Boston Tea Party and taxation without representation. But then there's a whole plethora of laws that underlie everything that we do, how we interact, what information we receive, where we can go, who we can interact with, all those things. It's all intricately entwined. And so that's why it is just so important to really focus on the underlying principles of all of our laws and protect that, because that is the genesis. That is the basis for all the rest of our laws. And if that is not in place and strongly upheld, then it causes everything else to go out of kilter. And that's really the focus, is to try to make sure that we really protect and stay well-grounded in what was the purpose of even forming the United States. Why are we here? So that's, you know, my focus. And I think most everybody that's involved is we really want to protect the underlying rights of every person.
And it affects everything. A lot of people might not think about this, but even in, say, family law, there are constitutional rights that are imbued by the 14th Amendment. And
can you give me examples?
Well, a very good example, and you know, having done a lot of family law over the last 40 years in this county, the Constitution protects personal relationships. The 14th Amendment doesn't just protect citizens. It talks about everybody who's born here is a citizen, but then when it talks about due process and equal protection, that talks about persons, not citizens. And so
if you look at the Constitution, it begins with that all human beings are imbued with certain inalienable rights.
Right.
And
yeah.
that doesn't say certain citizens. Uh-huh. So that's why we really focus on more than just citizens, because the whole purpose of the Constitution is to protect the rights of human beings, all of us.
So in for instance, in family courts, we all run into the issue that a parent and a child have a constitutional right to maintain their parent-child relationship. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really a mystery when we have an administration that starts taking children away from parents at the border, that those people, those persons, even if they've come over the border illegally, still have a constitutional right to maintain that parent-child relationship.
And that's where that argument comes in, into the courts.
That's right.
For that, I see.
That's
and
right.
It goes back to the constitutional law.
And that can't be severed without due process and equal protection. And so, and of course, you have... you know, you have rights to a jury trial that
right.
that are in other amendments of the Constitution. So these are very important rights that apply to all persons.
So now I'm looking at it, Stu has with him you've probably seen it or you have one too. He's got this little booklet that is the Constitution and all the amendments. Right, all 27?
All 27, right. 26 amendments. No, 27 amendments. And the beauty of it...
A little booklet.
Well, that's the beauty of it, is this was the first and most significant explosion of democratic freedom in the world. And it's resulted because of its structure with separation of powers and...
Can you talk about that, the separation of powers? Sure. Because, you know, a lot of the stuff that you're bringing up, both of you, are things that we're hearing a lot about. And not just because, you know, for those of us who slept through civics course, it's, you know, and I'm not putting myself in that category at all. But so talk about that, you know, the first thing. My understanding is the Constitution was what, 9 pages?
Well, it's very short, and this is why you can carry it around in your pocket.
Yeah.
And yet it's a framework for operating a democratic, republican form of government that has lasted now for 231 years.
And so talk about the separation
Medora, you want to take that?
Yeah. Well, I just want to remind people about when the Constitution was being formed. If you think about what was going on at the time, we had a certain King George on the throne in England.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar with Mad King George.
Right.
But he had bouts. And it's my belief that the colonists were looking at England saying, oh my goodness, we have a king who is out of his mind, doing these crazy things, saying these crazy things, and the last thing we want is for there to be a consolidation of power with one person or a small body.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's where I believe we get the separation of powers is to provide a balance so that you don't have to only depend upon this organization lasting. Our democracy can weather someone on the throne or in a, you know, one person having a concentration of power. It's balanced by the legislature, by the judiciary. And so I am just so happy that, in one sense, I'm always very thankful for Mad King George, because had he not been on the throne, I don't think we would have the kind of democracy that we have with the separation of powers that can withstand all the changes that we've seen over the years.
Right. And that, so the challenge, you know, the challenges that have come across have been in whether or not those separations are a check and balance for one another. And so far that's been tested.
Well, it's been tested many times.
Yeah.
I think every generation is faced with a test of this in the history of our country. You can start with Marbury versus Madison and some of the very early Supreme Court cases where the Supreme Court exercised its right to check the executive branch or sometimes the congressional branch. Mm-hmm. And until those cases were heard and decided, you know, it was kind of unclear. And of course, Marbury versus Madison, what's that about? Banking. Because there was an issue of whether Congress had the power to set up a federal bank or whether only states could do that. And you know, that seems pretty sanguine now.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was a pretty big deal. And so here was the Supreme Court telling both of the other branches of government, no, we make the decision. We make the final decision here. So, and you've seen that in the past when Congress has stepped in to check the executive. When Andrew Johnson was president after the assassination of Lincoln, he was taking actions to reverse essentially the end of slavery. And so Congress stepped in and, well, they made it illegal for him to fire any of the members of the cabinet that already had office. And when he started to, and he opposed the 14th Amendment and he opposed the 15th Amendment to the Constitution that would have extended civil rights and
to the slaves.
To the slaves, yeah. And voting rights to the slaves. You know, he just refused to go along, and so they impeached him. Now, for a lot of people, there's a two-step process. There's the impeachment by the House of Representatives, and then there's the trial in the Senate that's presided over by the presiding judge of the Supreme Court. So the vice president, who's usually presiding, doesn't have self-interest there. And I mean, you look at how this was carefully designed, and it's really quite marvelous. But in that case, the Senate decided not to convict. But what if any of your listeners are interested, there's a really good book called First Son about John Bingham, who wrote and pushed through Congress the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. He prosecuted the impeachment from the House of Representatives, and essentially Andrew Johnson backed off and agreed that he would sign and approve of the 14th and 15th Amendment, and he stopped firing all those cabinet members. And
it's amazing. So but, you know, happened. And you brought up something of just how intricate this document and this structure is, that it would be thought of, you know, conceptualized. And parts of it have been through the amendments, correct?
Well, yes. And, you know, one of the fascinating things, if you have your little pocket guide with you, you find out that the convention was presented to the Congress, and they sent it out to the states, and it wasn't ratified until 1789, but it was ratified on condition that there be a Bill of Rights added to it. And that was because Virginia refused to ratify it without a Bill of Rights. New York followed suit. And North Carolina wouldn't come into the Union unless there was a Bill of Rights. There was one state that refused to ratify the Constitution altogether. That was Rhode Island, but a fleet was sent, and they changed their mind.
A fleet was sent?
Yes, George Washington sent a fleet.
Oh,
and the legislature changed their mind, and they ratified it. But essentially, about half of the states required that there be a Bill of Rights attached, and Madison, who had helped write the Constitution, didn't think there needed to be one, but then he went about writing one.
So Midori, can you kind of break down, kind of in a summary, what the Bill of Rights added to the direction of the Constitution?
Well, I think Stu's better at answering this sort of question, but my basic understanding or how I view it is the Bill of Rights, we really consider what's in there in the Bill of Rights to be the Constitution. If you speak to the layperson, the things that are contained in the Bill of Rights are kind of, I would consider them more the human rights, whereas the original Constitution had more to do with banking and the administrative structure of the United States.
So the governmental structure.
Yes, and that's very well said, Midori. The founders who were putting together the Bill of Rights had read a book by Machiavelli. Yes, I know. Everybody laughs at that. And the truth is, Machiavelli had been held prisoner by a Medici, ah. And his condition for being, because he was a historian, his condition for release was to write a book called The Prince on how to be a good tyrant or a successful tyrant, mm-hmm. and a long-lived tyrant. So he did. And then when he was released, he wrote another book, which is hard to find or hard to remember. It's called The First Decade of Titus Livius, who had been a Roman historian and had gone through all the history of different governmental entities in the Mediterranean. But it's a guide to how to build a functioning, lasting, democratic, republican form of government. And many of the founders had this on their bookshelves. They'd read this. And that's where, actually, they came up with the separation of powers to have a big dose of democracy in, say, the House of Representatives, a big dose of monarchic stability in an elected president who wasn't going to be there forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then a Senate and a judiciary that also provided independent points of power, so that if any one of these went out of whack, there would be other places.
There'd be a second check. Yeah. That's interesting. So mm-hmm. so this is really built upon an avoidance of a Machiavellian system.
Yes, that was his answer to what he'd written.
That's so interesting. I had no idea. That's incredible. This is Chris Kington Barker, and you're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. The focus of today's show is the importance of individual rights, civil liberties, and the influence of the Constitution and what it does for our daily lives. My guests for today's show are Stu Jenkins, public interest lawyer and secretary of the SLO chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, Midori Feldman, attorney and president of the SLO County chapter of the ACLU, is with us by phone today. And you're invited to join us in our discussions with your comments, questions. And you can do that by calling us at 805-781-3875. One more time, you're welcome to call in. It's 805-781-3875. That is fascinating. I had no idea about that.
Well, it really is.
And it makes sense.
It really is fascinating. And so what you realize is that the whole arc of justice during the Renaissance was aimed towards the creation of a place like the United States of America.
Yeah.
But it took pilgrims fleeing religious persecution, for the most part, getting on boats and somehow surviving to come over here, and starting to make a life in a wilderness, and it was the fact that they were able to make those lives out here on their own and essentially take control of their own destinies that gave them the impetus to create an independent Republican democracy.
Yeah.
When Mad King George, as Midori mentioned, started imposing all kinds of things like the tax on tea, a monopoly on tea. You know, a lot of the people that made their living here were doing it by shipping,
mm-hmm.
and so suddenly they couldn't go get their own tea and bring it in. They had to pay the East India Company for that privilege.
Right.
And King George started shutting down our courts, and we weren't able to get to justice. Nobody could, if somebody stole your pig, you couldn't sue them.
You had no reprise.
You had no reprise.
Wow. That's incredible. What are, when we talked about at the front of the show, you were talking about this event that you have coming up.
And we have a barbecue on the 15th, which is Saturday. at noon at Santa Rosa Park. There'll be tri-tip, there'll be lamb, there'll be hot dogs, hamburger. And of course, the great thing is we're going to have programs on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And we're celebrating the Constitution's adoption 231 years ago. And it's just a fun time. We do this every year.
What kind of stuff do you
well,
do?
Well, and
you
it's
do?
Our kickoff for our scholarship fund that we're trying to build. We had a very interesting meeting back in March where an idea was brought forward by one of the non-board members of the ACLU, and with a suggestion that we look to trying to generate interest and an understanding of the Constitution through having a school program where students in the local area would write essays about the Constitution, and then our hope is to raise money to provide substantial, you know, some scholarship money, prize money for students participating in this. So it's our big kickoff event.
I think it's a great idea.
Well, and the board has decided that what we'd like to do is have basically fourth grade level essay contest, a middle school essay contest, mm-hmm. and an essay contest for juniors and seniors in the high schools. And we have given, I know Midori has done this, I've done this, several of our board members have gone to middle schools and high schools, and we've also given programs at Cuesta College. In fact, we have two more coming up this next month at Cuesta College on the Constitution for students. And we have speakers available for any school that would like that.
What are some of the things that people are most fascinated about what you're teaching in the schools? What's a story from you, Midori, something that has come up, that something you've learned that you share that entertain the students or that kind of pique their curiosity?
I've done talks on what to do when you're stopped by law enforcement, not necessarily what to do, but what to be aware of. And students especially are very interested in just understanding what is this process and what should I be looking out for. And we do some scenarios. We'll walk through and I'll have a volunteer come up, and they just think that's really great. And it really brings home for everyone, because everyone thinks, oh, you know, this is never going to happen to me. I never have to worry about these things. And so I'll bring somebody up, and I'll just be talking with them casually, and then all of a sudden it turns into a detention, and they don't even realize it's a detention. They don't understand what a search is, whether or not they should be giving permission, what their rights are to say, no, thank you. And so they're always very fascinated by those kinds of things.
And do you tie, when you're demonstrating that or when you're talking about that, do you tie that back into the Bill of Rights and which of those rights that really infringes on?
Yes, we always talk about, you know, we do a scenario and then we talk about the various Bill of Rights and where they come from. And we try to tie it into something that they can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
None of this makes much sense until you yourself have had to experience something.
Yeah.
And so that's what the purpose of going through the scenario, so the students can have an immediate understanding, a physicality to this Constitution, this thing that seems so heady and, you know,
not relevant to them.
It's very relevant.
Yeah, yeah. How about you, Stu?
Well, I think we've had similar experiences. And these are the kinds of things that at the Saturday noontime barbecue at Santa Rosa Park we'll be going through.
Oh, that's great.
For instance, you've got a cell phone here, and
right.
it's just a beautiful big cell phone. It has all kinds of information in it, probably. I bet you've got photos in there. I bet you've got the names of all your friends and their phone numbers. And
all two of them.
Common locations where you travel.
Yeah, it keeps track of where you go. And the question is, does the Constitution protect some from you from having that seized by an authority and have them go through it to determine where you've traveled, what photos you've taken, and who you know?
Not at the Canadian border.
Well, probably not, but that's because you left the country. What I'm saying is the Fourth Amendment,
yeah.
And this is a very practical thing that students immediately grasp,
right.
Protects you from having that phone examined, all the information downloaded into police custody if you're stopped for a speeding ticket.
Yeah.
Or if you're stopped because you cross the street without a crosswalk being there. There's no problem.
If you don't have your thumbprint or whatever to go into, you do have to have it protect. You have to do a double thing of security. There's been a bunch of things going on with that.
Even then, there's protections, and there's recent Supreme Court cases on this that in fact, one was Justice Scalia said that papers and your effects were now kept on your phone, and it was very personal, and therefore the police had to have probable cause to get a warrant to go into your phone, just like they'd have to have probable cause to go into your house.
Yeah.
And so these are issues that come home to people.
Okay.
I guess we have a caller.
We do. We have a caller. I'm going to try and bring in Hilo.
Yes.
Hi.
First of all, I'm mad at my calendar. It's not on there.
Oh.
But that's the 17th, and it's not on there either.
No. Chris described it as a holiday, and they don't give anybody work. Off from work for Constitution Day.
Oh, you're right. It's not a holiday. Well, it could be if you got real celebratory about it.
But it should be on your calendar.
Yeah. It should.
Be up there with the 4th of July, actually.
Yeah.
Listen, I had a question about the Mad King George. I learned that King George had a non-fatal disease called porphyria, in which the urine turned blue, and he acted mad for a long time, and I don't know how he got over it, but he did.
He had blue urine?
Yeah.
You called in to say he had blue urine?
In to say that if it's
there's a movie on that.
George, he had porphyria, which
medical blues, but
The blue isn't the main thing. It's
porphyria. Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Porphyria affected his mental abilities. Now, I'm not sure if this is the same King George. That's the thing.
And I think the takeaway is that he came in and out of sanity. Mm-hmm. He had bouts of sanity, but then he had bouts of real lack of judgment, and his behavior was, very difficult to deal with. So by building a system where you've got a balance, where you've got a chance to depose or change the leadership, that's all integral to having a stable form of democracy.
That's
a good illustration of why we have the separation of powers.
That's the difference between a democracy and a monarchy.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
The other thing I never knew about the origins of the ideas that led to the Constitution through Machiavelli and the
that is fascinating.
Roman.
I mean,
what the name of the Roman person or writing was.
You can just look for it's titled. You can get it. You can download it for free some places.
A book? Oh, okay.
But it's you can get it at any used bookstore. It's sometimes titled The Discourses of Titus Livius, or it's the first decade of Titus Livius, Discourses, it's all written by Machiavelli. He got I think he went up to Florence where he had a patron who was willing to protect him from the Medicis.
That's mentioned in the Alexander Hamilton book. He wrote a majority of the Federalist Papers.
Oh, the Federalist Papers, right. That's become a term, Machiavelli, that means somebody bad.
Yeah, bad? It's a bad rap for poor Machiavelli.
It is. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for
being thanks for
on.
Calling in. Hi, Lo.
Wonderful.
Be sure and come to the barbecue. Bring all your friends.
If I can. I don't eat a lot of meat, so.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye, hi, Lo.
Bye.
So you were talking about the kinds of things that you would be teaching, and you're going to be doing this at the barbecue, which I think is a great way for me. That's a great way to learn. I love that because it's relevant to what's happening for people's lives.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's so much. Once you understand the history of the Constitution, it brings things into balance. For instance, I'm sure Midori and I did a program at Cuesta College a while back, and we just asked the simple question, does the First Amendment prevent a state from establishing a religion? And, most people say, well, of course, because there's a separation of church and state. But the reality is that of the first 13 states, 13 of them had established religions. And by the time the Constitution came into effect, there were 7 of them that had tax-supported established religions. And some of them were very broad. For instance, in Georgia, you could not serve on the state legislature unless you were Protestant. So you could be any kind of Protestant. You just couldn't be Catholic or Jewish or Muslim. If you read the First Amendment and you see that the very first clause is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, I mean, this is the most important part of this, because it's first. Well, that was to keep the Congress from disestablishing the congregational religion that was mandated in Connecticut. It was to keep it from disestablishing the Quaker religion in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And it was to keep Congress from setting up some sort of religious test. Now, after the 14th Amendment that extended the rights of the Bill of Rights to citizens against their own states. See, before that, the Bill of Rights only applied to Congress. And so in South Carolina, for instance, before the Civil War, a law was passed that I think it was a death penalty offense to publish any tract that suggested the abolition of slavery. And I think there was a warrant for Abraham Lincoln's arrest. So there was no First Amendment protection against the state of South Carolina. And after the 14th Amendment said that the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States would apply to the states and the states could make no law or enforce no law that abridged those, suddenly you had the First and Second Amendment and Third Amendment we don't deal with too much anymore. The state could no longer station troops in your house. That's the Third Amendment, but all of these rights, the Fifth Amendment, you can't testify against yourself. The Fifth Amendment didn't prevent you from testifying against yourself in a state court, or from being compelled to testify.
Only in federal court.
Only in federal court. So suddenly, this was all applied against state governments, and that's where you had a significant change. When people talk about evolution of the Constitution, the last state to disestablish its established religion was, I can't remember, Midori, was it New Hampshire or North Carolina? Anyway,
I don't remember.
It was like 1875. It was well after the Civil War.
Wow, that's incredible.
So, yeah.
And, I think what this illustrates is, some people like to say, oh, I'm a strict constructionist. I believe exactly what the forefathers wrote. Well, if you look at it, it's been amended again and again.
Right.
It's been interpreted differently So I just have a really difficult time with people that, you know, want to get very hardened about what the Constitution is. And, you know, when they talk about things like gun rights, they say, well, it was established in the Constitution. I get that. But the world has moved on from muskets, and the Constitution in every area has moved on, and we need to adjust. Our society needs to be willing to adjust to our needs for today. And it can.
Right. And, you know, and the amendments that have been established have been progressive as new things have been discovered, as you said, or things have progressed.
Oh, sure.
Out of necessity, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, for instance, we decided we no longer wanted our state legislatures choosing our senators for us.
Mm-hmm.
So it was amended so we could elect our senators.
Right.
From states. And you know, when we discovered that the original provisions of the Constitution that set up the formula for how to elect presidents and vice presidents, Jefferson and Burr were on a ticket together. They were both Democratic Republicans. That was the Democratic Party's title in those days. And by golly, they got a tie in the Electoral College, and Burr said, well, doesn't that mean I'm president? And Jefferson, well, anyway, they had a go-around for a while, and they finally Congress had to step in and solve it. And Jefferson became the president, and Burr became the vice president, but they had to amend the Constitution so that it was set up to where you'd elect the ticket. You wouldn't elect the one person.
I see. Yeah.
Because the way the original formula was set up is whoever got the most votes in the Electoral College would be president, and whoever got the second most votes
you'd be runner-up.
Would be runner-up, which, of course, set it up so your opponent.
Right.
Yeah.
The person you really couldn't stand was your vice president.
Right.
And
so for the listeners out there, I've been just engulfed in the musical Hamilton. And if you listen to Hamilton carefully, it discusses so many of the topics, that topic about that the second person getting to be vice president is discussed there and how they did away with that. It has to do with Aaron Burr and Jefferson. It talks about all of that. So many of all of these subjects that we've been talking about. So if you want some way in and you're saying, I don't want to read even that little booklet. I don't want to listen to the soundtrack. If you've got Pandora, it's on there completely. You download
great,
the whole thing and listen
suggestion.
To it.
It's great.
Because it goes through in a very immediate way through rap music and hip hop. And it's listenable, has a good beat, and you can get through the material.
Yeah, that is a great idea. I'm Chris King DeBarker with you on Central Coast Voices on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Reminder that you can make listening easy by just saying play KCBX on your smart speaker. If you just joined us and you want to hear this entire show, local programming on KCBX is available on demand by going to kcbx.org and clicking on demand under the How to Listen tab on our menu. Then select the show you want in the drop-down box. We have about 15 minutes left in this show. You can still call in with questions or comments to 805-781-3875. Again, 805-781-3875. We're talking with Stuart Judkins, public interest lawyer and secretary of the SLO chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, and Midori Feldman, attorney and president of SLO County chapter of the ACLU. I want to get back to talking a little bit more about what when you guys talk about Constitution, obviously you go to adult parties and stuff. What's one of your big irritant for you, Stu, about a misunderstanding about the Constitution or the Bill of Rights that people seem to have?
I enjoy people too much to get irritated.
Oh, you never get irritated.
But
oh, you're a better man than me, sir.
no, we get a lot of we certainly get a lot of discussion about the Second Amendment, and
that seems to be the biggie right now. Yeah,
and there's because of recent events, we certainly get a lot of discussion about personal rights of people who are immigrants.
Right.
Somebody's waving at it. Anyway.
No.
Okay.
And do you think it's a misunderstanding are these people that are just speaking from what they've heard rather than reading? Or
One of the unique things about the Constitution, unlike laws that are put together by legislatures, is it was ratified. It was put together by the Constitutional Convention, many of whom were lawyers.
Yeah.
Some were bankers. Some were publishers. Some were farmers. But it was the first time in history that the people who voted on what a law was going to say was all of the people out in the neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And so this was the first time that all men, not women, except in Connecticut and New Jersey.
Yeah, I was going to talk to you about that. But
well, we're going to get into the 19th Amendment.
Right, Midori?
But this was the first time that every man over the age of 21 got a vote on something.
Yeah.
Before that, you had to have property, et cetera. So it was actually adopted by the people. It was written so people could understand it. It's actually very straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then you have to look at the times. So, say, on the Second Amendment, in those days, every man in every state over the age of 16 was a member of the militia.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it was. And every couple of weeks, you'd go to the town square and you'd drill and you'd do target practice and you'd elect your officers. And, if you were a kook, you'd get shunned out of the militia.
Mm-hmm.
But it also meant that there was a certain amount of discipline. In today's world, when you can go down and buy an AR-15 and you don't know even how to clean it in some states, do you have that overarching structure of responsibility mm-hmm. that militia provided?
Mm-hmm. It's a different time.
It's a different time.
Yeah.
And so those are issues that I think we're struggling with. But on the other hand, I'm old enough, and I know you aren't, Midori, to remember sitting in my dorm room at Cal Poly and hearing the newscaster come on and say, I don't believe this. I'm just going to read this to you. Governor Brown, the young Governor Brown,
I remember,
announced today—
Moonbeam. Yes.
Announced today that if President Nixon cancels the upcoming presidential elections as the constitutional commander-in-chief of the California militia that's made up of every man from 16 to 65, he will take up arms and march on Washington. That is part of the purpose for the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
So we really need to stop yelling at each other and start understanding.
Yeah.
The purpose was for a responsible set of rules that allowed people to protect their homes, their families, and their states from tyranny.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We've got a couple of calls, so I want to get to those. We've got Joe. Are you there, Joe?
Hi, Joe.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. Did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, we're talking about the history of the Constitution. So, part of that is political parties and how they view it themselves. And, we're bringing up Hamilton, Washington. One thing I've always read about Washington was he did not like political parties. I was wondering what your opinion was on that and how that, affected how, the amendments became.
Well, that's a very good question, Joe, and you're right. Washington didn't like political parties, and in fact, the Constitution probably never would have been adopted except for the fact that he had promised to be the first president. because he was the only one who was so nonpartisan and so civil and had such self-restraint that everybody trusted him. Political parties essentially happened a little bit, well, it happened fairly early. And in some of the amendments having to do with voting rights, you're going to find that those amendments have essentially structured the Constitution now so that it does provide for political parties. It doesn't say so, but in order for any group to be able to put together the cohesiveness to be able to change the Congress or change the presidency, they pretty much have to be a nationwide political party.
Understood.
So I hope
that
helps.
That does answer my question, definitely.
Well, thank you for calling in, Joe.
All right, thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye.
And John, hi, are you there?
Hi, yes.
Hi, did you have a comment or question?
Yeah, I have a question. I need some clarity on understanding how, because there are three branches of office. You have the president, executive branch, congressional branch, and judicial branch. But I'm wondering how executive powers can just overwhelm this check and balance system and basically allow a president to override what the founders originally set in place as a check and balance against that type of power.
Midori, did you want to take this
one? Well, you know, I think a lot, and if I could just make some conclusions about that question, is that what we're seeing now, it seems like it is executive power that is overpowering all the other branches. But I think that's a little bit of maybe a misperception that I see happening, is that Congress is not doing their job. That's what I just have to say that, because they are many in the one party or the various members are not standing up and saying, no, we're not going to go along with what the executive wants, and they're not forming the firewall that they are supposed to form. And so it seems like the executive is exercising too much power. And I think that he's exercising the power that he has, but it seems like he's exercising more power than he has because the firewall of Congress is not happening now.
Hmm.
So
and if I could,
that would be my comment about that question.
And if I could add to that, I think the genesis of that, John, is the nuclear age, because as soon as we had a situation where a foreign power could take out our major cities with no more than 20 minutes notice, I think Congress started at that point to abdicate its responsibility to be the only branch that could declare war by effectively authorizing a great deal of power to the executive so that in case the Russians decided to take out Seattle and Los Angeles, we could respond immediately. And unfortunately, that's a bad habit. And I think Congress has gotten in the bad habit of giving away more and more power to the executive over the years. They can take it back.
So you're saying the structure is still there.
It's still there.
It's just not being implemented.
I think that's right, Chris.
Yeah. Does that answer your question, John?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Okay.
You've been very informative.
Thank you.
Come to the barbecue.
Thanks for calling in.
Pushing that barbecue. We got to raise money for these kids.
And if you're a vegetarian, I'm sure they'll throw on some veggies.
We'll throw some potatoes on.
I have a very busy schedule, but I will do my best to attend.
All right, John.
It's the one next to Sierra Vista.
So we've got a few minutes. I want to make sure that we're getting to the things that you both want to address. So, Midori, I'm going to go over to you. What is it that you want to make sure that we get spoken here?
Well, I think by Mr. Jenkins and I representing the group on this program, it gives a little bit of a misconception about what the ACLU is and the makeup of the ACLU. It sounds like it's all a bunch of attorneys, but the attorneys are only a very small part of what is needed to support and keep strong the Constitution. And everyone is welcome. And it really, we need non-attorneys, people outside the law, to help us, because we kind of get a little bit of this, we can't see the forest through the trees.
Yeah.
We get on these little legal issues, and we don't take a step back. And we sometimes, it's very easy to forget when you're going into the minutiae of some of these constitutional issues, to forget about how does it apply to everyone.
Right.
And some of the best conversations I've had is when I'm talking to a non-attorney and they'll ask me a question, and it's almost like a sledgehammer over my head. I'm going, wow, why did I forget that?
Yeah.
And so I really want people that are not attorneys to please, you are so welcome, you are so needed, and I hope you don't let the fact that we've got two attorneys on the radio right now put you off of attending and fully participating in the group.
Well,
we really want you.
Fantastic. And we got about a minute, Stu, for you.
Lamb leg, tri-tip, hot dogs, hamburgers, Santa Rosa Park. Saturday, noon, celebrate Constitution Day, help raise money for essay contests for students. Y'all come.
And they'll be able to learn more about the Constitution.
Absolutely.
The Bill of Rights. Ask the kind of questions that we had great questions on the show today. And, you know, great answers. I mean, I've learned great stuff. I'm going to use that at some party. I'm going to tell you the Machiavelli thing. I'm going to throw that into a Trivial Pursuit party.
Yeah, that's right. Machiavellian should actually be a term for building a Republican democratic form of government.
Absolutely.
All right.
I want to thank my guest today, Stuart Jenkins, public interest lawyer and secretary of the SLO chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, Midori Feldman, attorney and president of the SLO County chapter of the ACLU, for joining me in today's discussion and for those people that called in. Thank you. Next week, host Fred Monroe will be here with Terry Baez, director of Central Coast Writers Conference, Wes Martin, Cuesta College Conference Coordinator, Ricky Roxburgh, and Donald Hewitt, when they discuss the importance of local conference as a place for assisting writers in taking their work to the next level. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX. All this made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellar Sargent. As always, your comments and suggestions for future shows are appreciated. Please send them to voices@kcbx.org. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining us on Central Coast Voices.